This is KTOO. We're live, we're local, and it's time for a Juno Afternoon. I'm your host, Julie Copins, here in the studio with producer Jeff Brown. And on today's program, UAS Associate Professor Saul Neely will be here to highlight new developments with the Flying University. We'll find out what's happening at ShoeFly this month with guest Eileen Funk. We'll get a preview of the new exhibit at the Alaska State Museum on the NN Cannery Project with Dr. Catherine Ringsmith. And Nancy DeCherney will be here with Arts Up. That, Bird Note, Music, and More on a Juno Afternoon.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The last year has been a roller coaster for healthcare policy as congressional Republicans fought to repeal the Affordable Care Act. Matt Laszlo reports from Washington on what tribal leaders are hoping for in 2018.
Despite numerous Republican attempts to repeal the Affordable Care Act, it's still the law of the land. However, Republicans have been able to chip away at it by removing the individual mandate, along with cutting some Obamacare outreach efforts. Dolores Curry is the Turtle Clan mother for the Piscataway Kanoi Tribe of Maryland. She says health care needs in Indian country aren't political, they're tangible.
We have the diabetes, we have those who have glaucoma, we have those who high blood pressure.
Curry says more funding is needed, and she doesn't like President Trump's proposal to cut Medicaid and Medicare.
We have Native families that make less than $15,000 a year. So how are they going to provide to be educated on health issues if they don't have money?
National and tribal leaders are trying to pressure lawmakers in Washington to pursue a number of different avenues to better distribute health care across the country. One of those is a controversial plan that would give tribal nations, or a group of tribal nations, the responsibility to administer Medicare and Medicaid services on their own. For larger nations, that may be an option, but for smaller tribes, like the Piscataway Kanoi, it's probably not feasible. Jesse Swan is their chief.
I don't know if we're able to take full advantage of that at this point in time. You know, you're controlling a large amount of money, and the state's been doing it, and, you know, trying to step into that right now would be add more to the plate, you know.
At this point, cuts to Medicare and Medicaid are included in the president's budget, but congressional Democrats are promising to block them. For National Native News, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
An international e-commerce retailer has relisted items that a Juneau, Alaska resident crafted from sea otter fur. It happened after the Alaska Native artist petitioned Etsy to relist the items, and U.S. Senator Dan Sullivan exchanged some letters with the company. KTOO's Trip Krause looks into the marketplace's policy and how it conflicts with a federal exemption to allow Alaska Natives to sell certain crafts.
Etsy says it's moving away from local and national laws, such as the U.S. Endangered Species Act, and toward international standards. Those standards don't include an exemption for Alaska Native artists. So the company says it removed ivory items from its website. Items made from endangered species, such as some populations of sea otters, were also removed. Marcus Goh is Inupiaq Eskimo. He hunts sea otters in southeast Alaska and uses the pelts to create scarves, gloves, vests, and other items. He heard of Etsy delisting other artists' items and reached out to his customer service representative out of concern. That's when the representative noticed his sea otter items.
After a while, she told me that because sea otters were endangered, my items would be delisted. And then this confused and it got me a little bit frustrated because they're not. We have so many sea otters here.
He petitioned Etsy saying that the population of southeast sea otters aren't endangered. And eventually his items were relisted. That was good news for U.S. Senator Dan Sullivan's office and spokesman Matt Shukaro.
The senator and also the office are hopeful that we can find a positive solution for those that may not have been able to relist their items, and we can find some resolution for those artisans.
Earlier this month, the Alaska Republican had sent a letter to Etsy following reports of walrus ivory and sea otter items being delisted from the online retailer. In Juneau, I'm Trip J. Krause.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service.
Support for this program comes from Montana State University in Bozeman, offering an on-campus master's and online graduate certificate in Native American Studies. More information can be found at montana.edu/Native American. Support for law and justice-related programming provided by Hobbs, Strauss, Dean & Walker, LLP, a national law firm dedicated to promoting and defending tribal rights for more than 30 years. More information available at HobbsStrauss.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Welcome back to A Juno Afternoon. I'm Julie Copens, your host, here with Jeff Brown in the studio on this snowy Thursday afternoon, February 22nd. Expect continued snow showers overnight. It'll be a high tomorrow near 35, so what's falling will likely go away. I'm joined in the studio now by UAS Associate Professor Saul Neely, and he has one of his star students with him, Blake Fletcher, who's a senior at the program out at UAS, and they're here to talk about the Flying University. And this is not, a kite flying club. This is not a pilot's club. This is something very special and unique to Juneau. Saul, what is the Flying University?
The Flying University is a prison education program I started in 2012 that brings university students inside Lemon Creek Correctional Center for mutual and collaborative study. We study philosophy and literature, and we take up a particular topic every semester, and we generally run that for about 10 weeks, with the exception of this semester. It's actually a full semester inside the prison. We've been going every summer since 2012, and some of the formerly incarcerated students who were part of the Flying University Seminar, several of them have been released since I started, and they continue their education at UAS. This past spring, we had two of our formerly incarcerated students graduate.
That's incredible. What an achievement for them and for you.
Yeah, it's pretty exciting. Yeah, two of them are in grad school now. So,
wow.
Yeah.
That's great. And I imagine we were talking before the show about sort of the idea behind this program. Maybe, Saul, I'll ask you kind of what motivated you to get this started, and how has it played out against sort of those expectations and hopes that you had?
When I was working on my PhD and writing my dissertation at Purdue University in Indiana, I had an opportunity to teach in prisons there. I was teaching for Indiana State University, and that was a typical class where I went into the prison and I taught a formal college class inside the prison. There were no outside university students from the community going in with me. And when I came to UAS and to Juneau, I wanted to see if there was another opportunity to teach in the prisons again, because I found it so personally edifying. Any point in my early 20s, I could have ended up in prison for
sure.
Any number of things, you know.
And, we won't get into that.
Right, exactly. But I ended up hooking up with Paul McCarthy, who's the education coordinator at Lemon Creek, and he and I have a wonderful working relationship, and he liked my idea, and so I met another guy named Steve Shankman out of the University of Oregon, and he runs a program called the Inside Out Prison Exchange Program, and that's where I got the idea to bring university students into the prison. And so that's where we started, based on that model. But we developed since then. And I think the biggest development that is most exciting right now is that for the first time, I'm actually bringing in the outside students coming in with me are enrolled in my Philosophy 201 Introduction to Philosophy class. And we, for the first time, have four inside students who are incarcerated at the moment getting full college credit. Because we were able to pull together from our community four scholarships for these students.
I was going to ask, who's funding all that tuition? But this is money that came donated from the community?
It is. We have two tuition waivers that come from Joe Nelson and the provost office at UAS. And then I'm going to give shout out to KJ Metcalf, who mustered the resources for the other two. And so we're hoping that this is an experimental run this semester where we've got inside students actually getting college credit and not going into debt. And we hope to be able to continue that and muster the resources to push that on down the road.
Right. Well, not to be too glib about it, but the way college costs are going up, like, maybe I want my kid to
get incarcerated. Right. You can go to college for free, but maybe that's not such a good idea. Okay. All joking aside. So, Blake Fletcher, your own sort of history that brought you to this, to being involved in this program, is a little different. Maybe share with me how you came to be involved.
Well, I grew up in the state of Vermont, Go Green Mountain State.
Mm-hmm.
I chose to come up and go to the University of Alaska Southeast, and I became an English major. And one of the requirements as an English major is Professor Neely's literary studies class. I believe it's English 215 is when I first heard of the Flying University program. And one day just before class started, he said, just so you guys know, if any of you are interested in coming in on a Friday to the prison and getting an extra look at this ethics as first philosophy, really dense and difficult literature, you're welcome to come in with me. And because my dad was in prison when I was a child, I thought it would be a very fulfilling experience to be a part of this program. And so I jumped on that opportunity, and for the next four semesters, I couldn't get enough of it.
What did you notice in those class sessions early on, sort of the dynamic between the classmates, and how was it different attending class inside Lemon Creek versus a typical UAS class? Was there a difference? What did you notice?
This is surprising, I think, for most people, but inside of Lemon Creek, in this tiny little library with no ventilation, the classes are phenomenal. All of the inside students, as we call them, come prepared to discuss and really keep the conversation centered in the text that we're reading that week. And in particular, like, honestly, they hold us accountable for getting the reading done.
Wow.
You can't make a claim without supporting it, and I love that. You don't necessarily get that at every class you get at UAS, but you definitely get it at every Flying University.
So it's maybe more challenging in some ways, just academically, in that group. You got to bring your game when you go in.
I feel like they really want you to try to relate whatever claim you're making straight to the text, which is extremely helpful when you're talking about hard-to-read philosophy, and the vocabulary is difficult for all of us, but I strongly believe that each and every one of the inside students is more likely to look up the definition of a word than any of my other classmates I've ever had. It's incredible.
Okay. What about from the instructor's point of view? What struck you about these students?
I think it's just the eagerness and, as Blake said, the willingness to put in the work. You know, I mean, that's pretty phenomenal. We see paperback dictionaries busted out every single class. And you just don't see a lot of people running toward a paperback dictionary anymore.
Right.
But, you know, and the kind of support you see, the classroom space inside the prison is kind of a utopian space within that prison.
Mm.
It's a space where normal social politics can be suspended for a moment, and people just really support each other and help each other try to learn this material as well as they can.
Mm.
So,
how do you see this project and in projects like it? I work in the theater, so I know there are a lot of programs of theater productions happening in prison or theater instruction programs, and it seems like a part of a larger societal trend away from kind of the lock them up and throw away the key attitudes of the 80s and 90s and toward a more enlightened view toward our incarcerated population.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you see that trend going as crime statistics go up and down? Sort of how do you see public support around these programs rising and falling?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think the tough on crime period is a bust. It's clearly a bust. Economically, it's unsustainable,
mm-hmm.
right? Morally, it's unsustainable. Economically, it's unsustainable. So there are perspectives from across the political spectrum that want to see these kinds of opportunities in the prison. And I think it also, it's a real testimony to the value and the necessity for humanities, you know, in our cultural and political dialogues, because they get marginalized, you know, whether it's from advocating for STEM at the expense of art or wherever it might be. The humanities traditionally get underfunded, defunded, or whatever it is, but this is an exercise in the concrete and material effects of what the humanities can do and is a sort of cultural, political intervention in our community.
Well, let me dig a little deeper on that, because, you know, there are some who might say, well, these incarcerated individuals, they should be taking vocational classes. They should be learning how to build an engine, or they should be learning mining technology. Why are they learning philosophy? What good is that going to be?
Oh, yeah, that's a great question.
You ever hear that?
Yeah, well, they have those opportunities inside, you know, Lemon Creek.
But I think when it comes to, you know, Socrates in the Apology says the unexamined life is not worth living. And I think that's that sense of restoring to these guys a sense of humanity and a sense of respect is so important and goes a long way, as Blake was telling the story earlier about, you know, incarcerated fathers inside of our classroom and trying to muster the self-respect to stay in touch with their kids. You know, that's all really important. And I've seen David Katzik, the Tlingit elder, twice inside the prison talk to a group of inmates, and he refers to them as beautiful and precious individuals.
Mm.
Nobody else calls them beautiful and precious individuals, right. You know? But if you can understand that people aren't reducible to the worst thing that they've ever done, and that every prisoner has a story, and that story doesn't get represented in any of the juridical records or in any of the court filings or whatever it is, and you attend to people as human beings at that level with their story in mind, then all sorts of transformation becomes possible, I think.
Right. I wonder, Blake, has it opened your mind to maybe some other connections with other people and maybe thinking about your father's experience? And I don't know, I wonder kind of how it's opened your mind.
I think it opened my mind day one of Flying University classes starting. We went in, we all introduced ourselves on the first day of class. There was kind of an icebreaker, and then we broke up into small groups to discuss what the class was going to be. And a gentleman approached me in small group, and he said, "Why are you here?" And I explained to him that my dad had been in prison. I have other family members that have been in and out of prison, and that the best days of the worst days that they described to me were the days that people came in to look them in the face and treat them as if they were human beings, whether it be playing games or having a church service or even classes like Saul teaches. But going in there and seeing that this person was incarcerated for whatever reason it may be, probably a mistake, probably had a large part to do with like a complicated life history that's more difficult than mine or more difficult than what I could understand. He walked right up to me and he asked me that. And as soon as I said that, he said, "Do you hate your father?" And when he said that, something kind of clicked inside of me, more like, I wonder if my dad was thinking that same thing the entire time he was in prison. If you have to wake up every day and feel like your most precious aspect of your life may be being separated from you daily by that disconnection. And I believe the statistic now is there's 1 million children who have a parent in prison.
Wow.
And that's pretty incredible to grow up with that disconnect and to see where each of these people have come from. And to get to hear some of the stories while trying to study ethics as first philosophy, because it shows me that where I started my life, I had a higher, I guess, view of what was going to happen. I had it easier. And a lot of these people didn't.
Wow. Go ahead, Saul. Yeah. You had a thought.
Yeah, and I really love that story because I'm a father, and a lot of the guys who take my class are fathers as well. And so we talk a lot about, you know, not just responsibility for people in our community, but this idea of being responsible for another person's responsibility. That's something unique to being a parent, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we connect on that a lot, like really helping each other fulfill our own responsibilities for the other, and that's pretty fantastic.
Right. I want to like sit down with you guys for a couple of hours and talk more about this because this is fascinating to me, and I'm sure to a lot of people. And I'm thinking of myself as an 18-year-old college student. You know, the hardest thing I had to deal with until then was like working on the prom committee, you know, and I'm just imagining the kind of conversations that come out of these philosophy classes. I bet it's amazing. So congratulations to you both on this. Last question would just be sort of what's ahead. What do you hope this program will evolve into? What are your do you have ambitions?
Well, that is a great question because you know, my dream was to get Inside Students college credit more than just the certificate of completion they have been getting up until this semester. But also, Blake is the first Flying University intern. This is part of his program requirements for the English degree, and so with Blake's help, we're building a website. We have become a 501c3. We just don't know what that means yet, but
it means, you know, I can donate money to you.
Exactly. So we're trying to figure out. We're trying to get all that together.
Okay.
We're building a website, another journal of poetry. You know, just sort of getting the word out there and mustering the resources we can to to really help deliver this kind of educational opportunity.
Is the website live or not yet? Or
no,
is there a place I can go to find out more, or will there be?
There will be by the end of the semester, right, Blake?
Okay. So maybe in a month or two, if I Google UAS Flying University, maybe I'll find you.
Yes.
And can chip in a few bucks for your fantastic work. Okay. Well, thank you both for coming in.
Thank you. Thank you.
Great to meet you.
You as well.
This is Bird Note. With its immense hooked beak, striking white head, and imperious pale eyes, the bald eagle's image holds sway throughout American life. The bald eagle stands proud as our national bird, spreads its wings on our national emblem, and serves as mascot of countless sports teams. So prominent is this iconic bird in our culture that we sometimes overlook an important fact. It shares the continent with a second, equally majestic eagle, the golden eagle. The golden, with a nearly 7-foot wingspan, matches the bald eagle in size. But its head and neck are lustrous golden brown, the source of its name. The two birds fill contrasting niches. Bald eagles, which are found over much of the continent, inhabit the water's edge and prey on fish and water birds. Golden eagles are birds of the West. They prefer mountain canyons, grasslands, even Arctic tundra, where they hunt mammals, especially rabbits. And while bald eagles are confined to North America, golden eagles are native to Europe and Asia as well. Long before the bald eagle adorned envelopes at the post office, the golden eagle flew the cosmos as personal messenger to Zeus, the ancient Greek overlord. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
Every Alaskan can make a difference when they file online for their PFD. Pick, click, give. A great and easy way to support nonprofits in Alaska. You simply donate during your PFD application process. There are dozens of nonprofits that you can support in Juneau alone, including KTOO Public Media. The application period for the PFD begins January 1st and runs through March 31st. More information can be found at pickclickgive.org.
And we're back with a Juneau Afternoon. I'm Julie Copins, and a fabulous pair of booties just walked in the door, worn by Eileen Funk. She is a shoenista. That is her official title. She works at Shoefly, one of my absolute favorite stores in Juneau. And the only thing that could have made Shoefly better was another location, which I guess just happened. So she's here to tell me about what's going on at both Shoefly locations. So, Eileen, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Tell me about your footwear. What do you got on today?
Oh, my gosh. Well, I'm actually wearing a new shoe that was just sent to us. We are not carrying it in the store quite yet.
So unfair.
I know. But it's this really cool company, and they're trying to meld utility with fashion. And so they're just fun, cute, hidden wedges with a great sole and a nice little lace-up that's kind of reminds me of like a hiking boot. And they're
this fabulous cranberry color.
Yes. And I think they're based out of Big Sky, Montana. I think like when I was reading about them that they found a lot of their inspiration for the styles and just like wanting to be outdoors and be able to wearing their shoes outdoors, like in Utah and as well as Montana.
Yeah. And are they leather, or let me just feel?
It is a leather shoe.
It's leather. It feels kind of rubbery, like it would be totally waterproof.
It is waterproof.
Treated leather.
Yeah.
And the sole is rubber and good for traction. And then, like you said, the wedge is hidden. So it looks like a flat boot, but it gives you a little bit of a lift.
It does.
Nice.
And I mean, I walk to work.
I need that.
So I'm super comfortable in them all day, running up and downstairs getting shoes. So yeah, hopefully we'll be carrying it in the store, and people can come check them out.
We will look out for those, and lots of other fabulous styles on display, I'm sure. I have to be, I'm not allowed in there anymore. I have to be very careful how many times I visit. Okay, so in addition to shoes, there is art happening at Shoefly. So tell me what's coming up.
So tomorrow we are going to be featuring Christine Kleinhens at our Valley location, our little Shoefly studio.
Tell me exactly where is that?
So it is in the little Chitty Chitty Airport mini mall, and that's different from the airport mall where Dames used to be. This is located right next to the Valley Restaurant. And if anyone knows where the Northern Tea House is or Freya, we're right out there on the far right-hand side of that little mini mall.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so you've got, say the name of the artist again, who's featured this final Friday.
Christine Kleinhens.
And what kind of work does she do?
So this collection that she's going to be featuring, it's actually her first time featuring it. It is acrylic being poured on canvas.
Hmm.
And so instead of painting it with a brush, she layers the paint in a cup after it's been mixed with a thinning agent and water, so it's the consistency of water. And then she either flips either a larger cup over and lets it just seep out and pour, or she can then pour it herself, which allows her more control in creating the images. So they are almost like this marbled look,
mm-hmm.
and they're very beautiful. And she named the collection Fluid, which was inspired by the movement of the paint over the canvas.
Right.
Just as she tilts the canvas to cover it completely. And she says, of course, as it spills off and onto her cell, like her hands and her feet, she says it makes the most glorious mess. So even off the canvas, it's quite beautiful.
Right.
Yeah, and even when she's done, and it takes about a week or two to dry, so quite the long drying process.
Uh-huh.
She uses heat or fire like a torch, and which will then pop the air bubbles within and give it even more texture.
Oh, wow.
So it's really however she's feeling with that individual painting, if she wants to leave it smooth, bring out that texture.
Sounds very unique. So this is a Final Friday exhibition, I guess, featuring. So what time, and is there going to be snacks, or what else is happening?
Yes, so she will be featured from 4 until 7 tomorrow night, but mm-hmm. the store will be open before then, so anyone can come on by, try on shoes, try on some clothes, because we do have quite a nice little clothes selection out there as well.
Right.
Yeah. So
okay.
A little bit of everything.
And then at the downtown location, that's always a great place to stop on a First Friday, which is coming
yes.
up in another
week or
two. Yeah,
we always do
okay.
a nice big First Friday. Yeah, so we generally have like little snacks, little drinks, always love having shoe parties, so come on in and check us out downtown. We have tons of fun in both locations, and so something at the beginning of the month and at the end of the month.
Right. Okay. Well, let me ask this. As a shoenista, is there some, you know, we love shoes wherever we are.
Same.
We, shoes are great. But is there something about living in Juneau, Alaska, or living in Southeast Alaska that makes, I guess, shoes a bigger deal, or sort of the stakes are higher, the shoes have got to work, they can't just look great? And that's something I really
exactly.
appreciate about what the inventory you've got at Shoe Fly, because those shoes work.
Yeah, so we really try to find styles that you can wear every day, that you're not going to be soaked through and cold and uncomfortable. So quite a few of our styles are actually waterproof.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're not waterproof, we always have our special spray to put on the leather to make it water resistant. But, yeah, we want comfort and style, so you don't have to give up one for the other, that you can have the best of both worlds.
Right. And then if you have a trip coming up, you want to dream a little bit. So I always see a few pairs in there that are really like, okay, I will never wear these in Juneau, but I will put them in my suitcase and wear
yes.
them somewhere else,
yes.
and I can dream.
Absolutely. And right now we're getting in boxes and boxes of shoes filled with all of our new summer styles. So we have some lace-up styles, slip-on styles, some great sandals that, of course, I've been trying on myself because I'm constantly shopping at work.
shame.
Yes.
Okay, great. And so what about artists who might be interested in having their work featured at Shoe Fly down the road? Is there an application process, or how do you get shown?
Yes, absolutely. You're more than welcome to contact Shoe Fly. And Callie Connerton is our event coordinator, and so if you go onto our website and grab our email, you can send us an email, or if you want to call in and leave your information, we'd love to talk to you about getting you in to show your work and talking about setting something up.
Okay, and what is the website address?
You could just Google Shoe Fly Alaska, and should be the first
okay.
thing that pops up.
And you'll find it. Okay.
Yes.
That's great. So for people maybe who are not familiar, let's say again where the two locations are, and if you want to shout out the hours or anything else we need to know before we go shopping.
Yeah, so our downtown location is right on Seward Street, right next to the Rookery. And then our Valley location is 9310 Glacier Highway, right next to the Valley Restaurant and the Chitty Chitty Mini Airport Mall.
Okay, and you're open 7 days a week? Or
Yeah, and then, well, downtown we are. And then in the Valley, we're open Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
Okay, so that's just a weekend thing.
Mm-hmm.
Gotcha. Yeah. And is it kind of the same inventory in both places, or does it vary? Or
There is a little bit of overlap, but we try to keep different collections in both locations. But we are happy to bring collections from downtown to the Valley, as well as collections from the Valley downtown, so that you guys don't have to make the drive.
Right.
Yeah, to make it easy for everyone.
And is it just for women, or do you have some children's and men's styles as well?
So downtown we have our men's selection, and then we do have some girls' shoes in the Valley as well as downtown for the children's styles.
Okay, yeah, I've seen some of the boots and things for the kids,
yes,
too.
Yeah, cute little glitter shoes.
They are.
Baby bogs.
I love seeing those little baby bogs. My baby's too big for those baby bogs, and I miss it. All right. Well, Eileen Funk, thank you so much for coming in,
yes,
and we'll see you
me.
At Shoe Fly.
All right, thank you.
You seen her running down the street. You seen her trying to catch the bus. Always complaining about her feet. But you know that you'll never give up those pointy toes, thin soles, high heel girl shoes. She used to be such a sensible girl until I saw her just last week. She wore a long, straight, tight gray skirt. She had those silly girl shoes on her feet. She had those pointy toes, thin soles, high-heeled girl shoes. Now as for me, I'm more the practical type.
Don't you know?
I choose an art support anytime.
Mm-hmm.
I look for comfort because it's what I like.
And those shoes make me lose my mind. I want those pointy toes, thin soles, high-heeled girl shoes. They give you bunions, corns, and calluses, mangled metatarsals, ingrown toenails are just a few I could name. And flat feet from flimsy arches, aching calves and swollen ankles, blistered, puffy, feeling parts and lower back pain.
I went out shopping with my girlfriend. We started trying on some fancy clothes. I turned around cause she was talking to me.
And in her hand she was holding some of those. She had those pointy toes, thin sole, high-heeled girl shoes.
Before I knew it, they were on my feet.
So
and I was walking up and down the floor.
Fever.
Who would have thought that they could look so neat?
Who would believe that I'd be trying on some of those pointy toes, thin sole, high-heeled girl shoes.
I felt just like a wuss to feel the rain. I felt that certain little swing in my head. I learned to suffer to be feminine.
Cause those shoes that got me in their grip. I love my pointy toe, thin sole, high heel girl shoes. I love my pointy toe, thin sole, high heel girl shoes. I love my pointy toe, thin sole, high heel girl shoes.
Yeah, these shoes. Made for walking.
February is Heart Health Month. Heart disease is the leading cause of death in the U.S. Risk factors include high blood pressure, high cholesterol, and smoking. Smoking weakens and hardens arteries and raises blood pressure. Protect your heart with more activity, a healthy diet, and quitting tobacco. Begin your quit story today. For free support, call Alaska's Tobacco Quitline at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. Brought to you by the Partnership for Tobacco-Free Southeast and Search.
This is a Juno Afternoon. I'm your host, Julie Copens, in the studio with Jeff Brown. And we are joined now by some guests. Dr. Catherine Ringsmith, Katie, as I'm allowed to call her, is here to talk about a fantastic history project, an exhibit at the Alaska State Museum on the NN Cannery Project. So, Katie, if you would, introduce who you brought with you today also.
All right. Well, I have two members of my team here. Very famous Bob King, Juneau resident. He's my fish historian on the team. And Larice Eagley, who is, she does a lot of the tech, the website development, and is filmmaker. She's here from King Salmon.
Welcome, Bob and Larice as well. So I will tell you, I had an interest in doing a theater project about the canneries in Juneau because it occurred to me, unlike the gold mining industry and some of our other local history, the canneries are really kind of an untold story. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that.
Oh, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, most people, when they think about the fishing industry in Alaska, often what comes to mind are the fishermen, especially in Bristol Bay, the iron men of Bristol Bay who fished in sailboats. But the reality is the people who really supported the industry and were central to it were the processors. And really, they are the invisible people of the industry. And one of the things that we're really interested in is telling the stories of these people so that they are better valued and understood in Alaska history, not to mention the role that they played throughout the Pacific.
And Bob, you're nodding your head. So, and I imagine out all the different cannery locations, maybe you had different mixes of populations, but with the NN cannery, who were these people? Tell me a little bit about them.
It's a real special cannery that was built in 1890 as a saltery, turned into a cannery in 1895. It operated almost continuously until what, 2001?
Yeah.
And it brought a number of people, not just as the fishermen. And the fishermen came from Norway. They came from Sweden. They came from Europe. They also came from Italy. They came from Croatia. They came from all of these different communities who were brought up just as the fishermen. The cannery workers themselves included originally a number of Chinese, later Filipino, from numerous other countries. Katie was saying that when you go out on the dock during their coffee break called mug up, that you could hear a dozen or so different languages being spoken. So it's a real broad, and it would vary depending on where, whether it was in Bristol Bay, whether it was in southeast Alaska. There's a lot of stories, but a similarity that many people from around the world actually came in to take part in this very valuable fishery.
And sometimes they just came from upriver.
Sure.
There was an important local community, Alaska Natives, who contributed, and they were central contributors to the cannery because when the cannery crews left, then the Native communities were the caretakers of these canneries, and that's a tradition that continues today.
Right. And were these mixed groups of folks, was it harmonious? Were there, I imagine, maybe some difficulties, some culture clashes, and maybe some economic exploitation going on?
Absolutely. And again, part of our project is to do a National Register nomination that tells the story of the people. But oftentimes, you can't find those stories in the archives today. You have to go on ground, and you have to see these buildings, and that's the story that the buildings themselves tell. So when you go into where the mess hall complex is, you'll see where they had segregated mess halls. You know, Filipino. They had the old white mess hall, but at the same time, there were also class differences. So the management ate in the blue room, and the machinists ate in the yellow room, and then everybody else ate in the main part of the mess hall. So, yeah, there were a tremendous amount of divisions, but at the same time, because this cannery lasted for so long, you see the discrimination, you see the segregation, and then you see how we evolved and how integration ultimately became the rule at canneries.
Right, and with a huge economic impact. I remember reading somewhere like that the Alaskan economy was built on canned salmon, not on oil, not on gold. It was canned salmon. Is that true?
Absolutely. The canned salmon industry before the 1930s, 1940s, it wasn't gold. It was salmon. In fact, canned salmon was third to timber and wheat in the United States on the West Coast in terms of its extractive industries. I mean, it was extremely valuable, and a lot of canned salmon came out of Alaska during the territorial days and went to other places, and actually that would become one of the reasons, the causes that Alaska will become a state.
Right, and I understand other world events had an impact on that because it wasn't during World War One, World War Two. Other foods were rationed, so canned salmon was a ready protein source for a lot of people
World
all over
War
the world.
In World War I, for example, canned salmon fed the troops in the trenches. It was a good protein food product to the point where they overfished the fishery, at least in Bristol Bay. There was a crash in 1919. They also brought things like the Spanish flu pandemic as well. So that had an enormous impact on Alaska. I mean, not just in Bristol Bay, where on the Naknek River alone, 200 people died in just a couple weeks. But we're talking about an event, a global event, where Alaska got hit hard. In fact, more people are going to die in Alaska from the Spanish flu pandemic than anywhere else in the world per capita. So this is an event where we can tell these stories. In fact, the hospital at the cannery, they reached out to the people who were inflicted by the flu pandemic, and they ended up saving a lot of the orphans, which was tragic and heartbreaking for the people there. But at the same time, that generation is going to be the generation that's going to pass the Anti-Discrimination Act and go on to lead Alaska, especially the Alaska Native community. So there's, you know, again, these stories that the buildings themselves, whether it's the hospital, whether it's the laundry, whether it's the fish house, that contain these stories of these people and how, you know, they did a lot more than just canned salmon.
That's amazing. And you mentioned, Bob, the mug-up tradition, the coffee break. So you all are taking part in a mug-up at the museum. Tell me about that, because I'm sure a lot of listeners are like me. This is amazing history. I've never heard any of this. I want to learn more. I want to come and hear what you all have to say.
Well, in 2015, Bob and I heard that Trident Seafoods was going to close this cannery, the NN cannery, which was, you know, started out as a saltery, was built by the Alaska Packers Association and ran for most of the century. And so we're going to talk about that history and the project, this very grassroots project, and all these different collaborators and partners that we that have come together to really work to share this story. And we're going to talk about the project and what we're going to try to achieve through this collaboration. And one of those is an exhibit at the State Museum called Mug Up, which really talks about cannery work, cannery people, and the place itself and how we connected these places and how ultimately that has influenced and shaped our Alaska history. So okay. It's going to be really fun, and I hope people come out and learn a little bit about this history and really how they can get involved.
And this is going to be, is it tomorrow? Did I get that right?
Yep,
the kickoff
Friday night.
Event?
Yep.
Okay, and what time?
5:30.
5:30 at the State Museum.
At the museum, right.
Okay, that's great. And you can find out more. Is there a website or another place where I can maybe see more about this project?
Larice here is actually developing our website, and she can probably tell you a little bit more about that.
Yeah, we're on the final stretches of polishing up the website to make that public. Probably the best place to keep up with the latest and the greatest. Katie puts in a lot of time into keeping things current on the Facebook page, and it's also a great resource for a lot of the other media coverage, a lot of other links to other history, interrelated projects. So I would say the Facebook page is a great place to start, and as soon as the website is ready for public view, we will announce it there.
Okay, so on Facebook I would search for what?
NN Cannery? NN Cannery History Project.
Okay, so that's two letter N's, NN Cannery History Project.
Yep. Oh, APA named all their canneries. For example, Diamond E was Anigigik, Diamond N was Nushagak, and Diamond NN was for Naknak. And they didn't actually call them Diamond, but they just used a symbol. So that was a bookkeeping thing. So romantic, but also very practical, too.
Sure. Yeah, to keep all that straight. Bob, I wanted to ask you, so I imagine as a fish historian, you see, I guess, remnants or echoes of this cannery history in our contemporary life. Do you notice parallels, or what do you see in Alaska today that might be a lesson from the past or connection to the past?
Well, you look at, go down to the docks and you can see boats and date several of them back, 50 years or more, that are still fishing today. There are even older boats that, out in Bristol Bay, that are still being used. There's so many remnants actually of the canneries. Many of the canneries have just fallen apart.
Right.
They've burned down. They've been lost. In Bristol Bay, there were over 60 canneries built throughout the years. There are only maybe 10 now that are still being used, and probably not more than 20 that physically exist. but many of those sites, some of the buildings, some of the equipment that was used many, many years ago is still around. A friend actually said he just got some coffee mugs actually from False Pass out in the Aleutian Islands that he found, which are very unique coffee cup. They look like a cup, but they don't have a handle on it. And they don't have a handle on it because if you're on a boat like that, you need to put it down. So I think fishermen invented the cup holder before anyone else did. But if you had a holder, so there are lots of little memories. But the best thing that's still there that you can find are the stories from the individual fishermen, the cannery processors, the local natives and the like, the fishermen and the biologists who were involved in the management of the fishery. They all have stories which are incredible. And part of this project, the Mug Up project, is to encourage people to tell their stories so they're recorded and preserved for history.
Right, because some of these folks are getting along in years and won't be with us forever, so we want to preserve their
stories. For example, Gary Johnson, he started out as a bookkeeper in Blaine, and he got hired came in 64 to work in Kodiak, which didn't turn out so well because the cannery disappeared with the earthquake. But he got hired by the Alaska Packers and was sent out to places like Igigik and other canneries in Kodiak. And when he retired in 1997, that represented the end of that era. He was the last of the Alaska Packer superintendents, and that was the end of an era. And very few, even Alaskans, know and understand this history. And I think, I live in Anchorage, and we like to talk about how Anchorage is a 100-language city. But as I share my history classes at UAA, I remind my students that that's terrific, but it's nothing new. That we here in Alaska have always been connected to the global world. And when we start to explain why we are so diverse, well, I think the canneries are a great place to start. Right, they were hubs. They were where all these different people came together. Sometimes it didn't turn out so well. Sometimes it, but the reality is that we were connecting with the larger world for a very long time. And I think, again, this offers us fresh ways to analyze Alaska and its larger position in the global world, that we're not the end of anything. We're not, we're not the last of anything. In fact, we're not the bridge to nowhere. We are the bridge. And when you look at our cannery history, we see how we are really those cultural hubs, and it's worth really understanding the connection between the past and who we are today.
Right. So having that understanding, but I wonder also lessons for the future. And you mentioned the in Bristol Bay, the crash that happened because of overfishing. Are there other lessons that we might draw from in terms of, more sustainable harvesting, getting along better with people of different cultures? I mean, what are some of the takeaways that you hope folks will have from this Mug Up, either Katie or Bob?
Well, there's fortunately right now Bristol Bay in particular is doing pretty good. They caught, I think, 250 million fish, which was worth over $220 million. So they're doing quite well. But that is only because the government actually made the state government made a committed effort in order to manage these runs, take the hard hits that we did when runs were weak, in order to maintain this fishery over many years. That's one of the big lessons. Things fluctuate though. Right now, cod is down. There are problems with other fisheries. But one of the lessons that applying scientific knowledge to these runs, managing them properly, means that this fishery will continue robust. Bristol Bay has been in existence for 135 years now. Southeast has had runs just the same, and they've benefited from the same tough steps that the state has taken over the many years. That's one of the big lessons.
Right. Anything you want to add to that, Katie? Lessons for maybe young people, young Alaskans looking at this history? What can they learn?
I think it was people worked really hard.
Yeah, they did.
They worked extremely hard. I worked my way all the way through college, right up to the PhD level, working in canneries. When my friends were going to Disneyland, we came up to Alaska, and I worked in a cannery. And I loved it.
It wasn't the happiest place.
The lessons for me is I grew up in a small town in Washington, and I came to Alaska, what a lot of people would think was the end of, America, so far out there. But it was as cosmopolitan as you can imagine. And I was around, I worked side by side with Filipino, fish slimers, and the Japanese technicians were in the egg house. You had not just the Aleutic people there, but you had Aleut people and Dena Inna people. So you had all of these different cultures. And I grew up without even thinking twice. The Croatian fishermen, you had the Italian fishermen, mm-hmm. you had women becoming more and more prevalent in the canneries in managerial positions, and even fishing. And I think for me, personally, that's the lesson that I took away, is that these canneries allowed me to experience the world by just going to South Naknek.
Wow. Globalization before globalization was cool.
That's right.
We're in it.
Yep.
Okay, I'm going to go crack open a can of salmon.
Excellent.
Thank you all for coming in. I can't wait to hear more at the Mug Out. That's tomorrow at the State Museum, starting at what time?
At 5:30, and I have lots and lots of photos to show. So it should be a really fun event. And a wonderful, wonderful film we're going to show, too, made by Larice and Sharon Thompson, filmmakers from Bristol Bay.
Excellent. Thank you all for being on the program.
Thank you so much
for
having us.
I am waiting on a girl.
Waiting on a girl.
Waiting on a girl.
They're waiting on me.
I am waiting on a girl.
She's got slime all down her dress.
Yeah, I'm waiting on a girl.
And she's a bloody mess.
Oh, I truly love her. I gotta confess. I'm waiting on a girl.
She's got entrails in her hair.
Yeah, I'm waiting on a girl.
And she don't really care.
All rubber boots and heli handsomes are her fare.
Oh, yeah.
I'm waiting on a girl.
And it's getting pretty late.
Yeah, I'm waiting on a girl.
And I can plainly say,
oh, she's more fun than a bucket full of bait. Well, I saw it for the first time walking down that dock. She had a humpy head in her hands. It really turned me on the way she packed her. So I really want to understand. My cannery girl. I love my can cannery girl. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Cannery girl. I love my can cannery girl. Oh, yeah.
Support comes from Southeast Living Magazine, Southeast Alaska's home, real estate, and lifestyle magazine, working to reach potential home buyers and featuring articles and tips on home improvement. Available at locations throughout Southeast. More at sckliving.com.
This station is supported by Breezin, carrying a variety of sandwiches, fresh baked bread, and pastries. Chef Moorhead offers daily changing menu choices for takeout and catering for special events and parties. More information at breezin.com.
And at 6 minutes before the hour, this is Julie Copens with a Juno Afternoon. I'm joined in the studio now by Nancy DeCherney. She's the Executive Director of the Juno Arts and Humanities Council. Welcome to the program, Nancy.
Thank you.
And Nancy joins us every Thursday with Arts Up. So what is up with the arts this week, weekend?
Well, there's a few things.
Mm-hmm.
if you want something to do this evening, Pub Theology at Barnaby Brewing is happening. It's an opportunity
Pub
to go.
Theology.
And, yeah, it's apparently you
I
go
like
and they have different topics for people to discuss. And I have to say, we had a very nice conversation at the Jack last night with a lot of people who were concerned about the wearable art piece. And I think maybe 50 or 60 people were there. Good conversation and good talk. And so I think it's a nice opportunity. The community has things to talk about, and we should get together more. And tonight you could go to the pub.
And talk about it over
whatever it is.
A cold beverage.
And I don't know what their topic for tonight is. But anyway, Friday, there is the final Friday shop hop out at the airport shopping mall. They do it. They have a scavenger hunt, I guess. So you go on their Facebook and get more details about that. And you can win. You can win things.
I like winning things. Okay.
Yes. Let's see. At Northern Light Church at, from noon to 1:30, Racial Equity and Liberation Learning Series. It's a sort of an ongoing series, but you could go there. It's, I think, sponsored by Aware. You can go at noon and hear the Kimball organ. Family night at the Turf from 5 to 6 out at the Diamond Park Fieldhouse. It's for kids 0 to 8, sponsored by Aware, and it's free. There's a kombucha tasting at Yoga Path from 5:30 to 7. Mug up, and you were just talking about that, right?
The Cannery Project.
The Cannery Project. There's a wine tasting over at TK McGuire's as a benefit for the Juneau Co-op Preschool. That's at 6 p.m. And at 7:30 p.m., Conbrio Chamber Series, Minimalism, Philip Glass, things like that, flute, music. It's going to be beautiful. Two opportunities for this one, Northern Light Church at 7:30 on Friday, and then on Saturday it's at the APK at 2.
And those, if people aren't aware, if you haven't attended the Cumbrio series, it's a way to hear music in a really intimate setting. If you're a fan of the symphony, it's just, I always find it really fascinating. And the players are so committed to this music, and it is always really professionally done and beautiful.
It's lovely chamber music. It's really a blessing to have these people here. That's all
lucky.
I have to say. Okay, so it's tax time, right? We don't want to talk about it. But if you need some help, the AARP Foundation has a couple of opportunities this week for you to go out and get some help with your taxes. Saturday, 11 to 5, out at the Nugget Shopping Mall. Let's see. There's a Sasquatch Scramble on the lower loop of the Nugget Nordic Trail at Eagle Crest. It's a fundraiser for the Seal Land Trust. It starts at 2, ends at 5. Heartbreaker Gigi Monroe is having the hottest drag heartbreakers at the Rendezvous at 7 p.m. on Saturday. 7:30, there's a February barn dance up at St. Anne's Parish Hall. So you take your pick. You got all kinds of things on Saturday. Sunday, it's from noon to 5, Juneau's Best Bridal Fair out at Mendenhall Mall. Starting to be that time of year. We have at the Jack, it's going to be very exciting at the Jack. We have Artists of All Nations, which we do at the last Sunday of the month every month. It's just open to all. Come bring your crafts, whatever you're working on, your artwork, share it, work on it, visit with other artists. That's from 1 to 5 in the main hall. In the gallery, if you haven't been to see the exhibit, it's gorgeous. Patty Hutchins Jupy, it feels like you're underwater. Mm-hmm. It has a very serene feel to it. It's a Chinese watercolor technique that she used, and she's going to offer some, show people how she did it.
Oh,
so,
wonderful.
And if you would like to participate, bring a 5x7 canvas, and she'll help you with that. And at the same time,
how do you choose?
In the other room, in the big hall, with the Artists of All Nations, Hank Van Dickerson is offering a Drag King workshop. So you can, it could be just fun to go down and watch and see all the stuff happening.
I'm curious.
Yeah. And from 3 to 4:30 at Northern Light Church, Jay Query is in recital. Beautiful tenor voice. And then at 5:15 at the Jack is Fusion Dance Lessons. So, and at 6 to 8 p.m., there's international folk dancing over at the Alaska Club. So Sunday's packed.
It is a busy weekend.
Yeah. Pickleball on Monday from 1 to 2 at Centennial Hall. There's a little charge for that. Not much, though. And we start our gospel workshops with Reverend Bobby Lewis and Eustace Johnson. They are bringing a guest, Ryan Shaw. So sign up for that and let's have a great time.
And that's all at jahc.org.
Uh-huh.
Excellent. And you've been listening to KTOO, and find us online at ktoo.org. This is Julie Copeland with a Juno Afternoon. Have a wonderful Juno evening. Tune in at 7 for February's Mudrooms.
This is KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juno and Douglas. We also rebroadcast on translators K276AF in the Mendenhall Valley and Auk Bay, K269AO in Lemon and Swan.